Hello and welcome to Zero Hour. This is Tim Bowen. Today's show is an ongoing series that explores Richmond's thriving art scene and the people that make it happen. Every Friday at 12:30, we sit down at a Richmond cafe and have lunch with one of these folks. Conversation is live and spontaneous, so pull up a chair and meet some fascinating people. Today we are talking to David Bruce. Welcome, David, to Zero Hour. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
I don't normally do this, but I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit here and ask you to give our listeners a little bit of information about your education and background.
Oh, wow. Well, I guess, you know...
You can start at like three or something like that.
Three is good, you know. I mean, you start from out of the womb or something like that. First light, I guess, or the smack, however it begins.
Right.
You know, I guess... Back in the day, good old high school stuff, I've always been interested in architecture, engineering,
oh, really?
Things like that, yeah. That's kind of how it all started, I guess, and my mom was an art teacher, so mm-hmm. I was playing with the paint from a young age, and clay, and just about everything
But
else.
Interested in architecture, I mean interested in buildings.
Yeah,
really.
Buildings and spaces, really important. You know, I think there's a heavy influence on the way that you develop based off of your environment, so... I found an interesting edge from that at mm-hmm. an early age. Mm-hmm. So I guess 15, 16, I went down to Clemson University, studied for two-week seminars each summer with Yuji Kishimoto, quite a fella, and mm-hmm. I was one of the youngest guys in there, just kind of thrown in with a bunch of, you know, 18, 19, mm-hmm. 20-year-olds getting ready to go into college. Here I'm 15 and trying to...
I'm sorry, I don't know who he is.
Yuji, you know, I don't know that much about his background. He's been right. teaching at Clemson for quite a long time.
And what's he teach?
I mean, I was 15. It was architecture.
Oh, it was? Okay,
yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So there were just two seminars, basically just a supplemental education mm-hmm. for kind of like an AP class that you mm-hmm. would take in high school.
Yeah, architecture is interesting to me because as a kid, I can remember being exposed to it, you know, ancient architecture, Greek architecture, that kind of thing. And it had zero impact. I mean,
zero.
It was like nothing. It was like, you know. And I can remember going to Paris in my early 20s and like, you know. And I went back later on in life, and it was just, I was just walking around with my mouth hanging open. I don't know.
Yeah, I've had a very...
I'm sort of a late bloomer as far as... To me, it was just a building. I mean, you know, come on.
Yeah. I mean, I guess about that same time, I'm in Italy at 15, and I was much more interested in the women and the wine than right. I was in the architecture around me and the Michelangelos and everything else you can see. Luckily, my mother has always been really interested in what I was doing and education, you know, mm-hmm. where the money's going.
Right, right.
So she pointed me in the direction of urban planning, which I immediately kind of fell in love with in some ways.
Really?
You know, dealing with the spaces on a much larger scale.
Uh-huh.
Came out of school with the degree in urban planning and a minor in ecology. And then took a couple years. I fell in love with climbing, actually, while I was in college and realized
fell in love with climbing.
Climbing mountains.
Climbing mountains.
Yeah, traditional climbing. Sport,
well, you look
climbing,
like a climber. For those of you who can't see him on the radio, it's tall and thin.
Tall and lanky. Yeah,
yeah right. Yeah.
So that actually had a huge influence on my development in my life.
Really? Why? Then,
well, you know, all these other things, your sciences and all these things, you're always in your head. You're thinking very little. There are very few times, I think, in a life outside of in athletics, which most runners or anybody that plays a major sport may have that moment where all the thought disappears.
Right.
And you're being
right.
human.
Right.
And you're reacting on the spot.
Mm-hmm.
I tripped over my own feet playing basketball when I was a kid. I grew too tall too fast.
Right.
So they put me at the boards, and I still couldn't catch a rebound to save my life. So I found climbing, you know, and here's this thing where I can be completely engaged with an environment. I can mm-hmm. scale the mountainside, and it just was such an exhilarating experience.
Did it scare you?
Didn't scare me.
Did
no,
not?
No,
the
didn't
heights
really
didn't scare
me. I thought for a moment, you know, am I going to be, because you think about stepping up to the edge mm-hmm. of just, and people with major fear of heights, you don't see them go anywhere near the edge.
Right, right.
You know, and you got these kids that'll run right up to it, mm-hmm. and, you know, mm-hmm. mom's in the background freaking out, like, oh my, I just had this happen this weekend. I went on a hike with a buddy of mine, Tom, and his two twins, and Tom's freaking out, but luckily he brought, you know, David the climber,
mm-hmm.
and here we are, and I'm like watching these kids, and they have no fear.
Yeah.
So they climb.
Well, for those of you who just tuned in, we're actually talking to David Bruce, the artist. But there's a lot of different ways to get there, so that's why we're talking about climbing, because of, I think you said something very interesting that I've heard a lot of artists say, and you said that moment where essentially your ego disappears.
Yeah.
You know, where you just are.
Yeah.
Is that what
That's a very important component of my work. Definitely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, you fuse all those different things, the planning and the climbing experiences. And I think I started to kind of have to simmer it down. And when you simmer down something, you know,
what do you mean simmer
down?
Simmer down.
Well, you know, like if you're making a beurre blanc, you know, you put the wine in and you put the butter and everything else. And then over a while, all the stuff evaporates that mm-hmm. doesn't need to be there. And then you've got the sauce.
Right.
And the sauce is what you're really working for here.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I have so many things that have influenced me in my life that at some point in time I realized I had to simmer it down. Mm-hmm. And find out what was really important and what I was working with and what I was doing in my processes. And so throughout that, I realized that I was working towards just being and the idea of becoming. So that, I guess it has a lot to do with finding an identity of some sort, a point of existence. And what I realized was that I had these multitudes of points, these permutations of points. And so I had to figure out what and how to get to those different points.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like navigating my own existence.
Can you name any of those points? Are they verb? Can they be verbalized?
Wow, I think, you know, if I pull it down into
I mean, you can talk about like
ordinary language, it's uh-huh. gonna lose so much.
Yeah,
and I think everybody
yeah.
as an artist would say that. You know,
yeah,
when you're
yeah.
translating, it's lost in translation.
Right,
of course. And so I do it with materials because for me the environment is like my first language system.
Okay, explain that. What do you mean?
I walk through the woods and the wind's blowing from the east and the leaves are falling in this direction and there's a thousand stories that I think the environments can teach you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people that track animals, you know, they're looking at the footprints and the paw
right.
prints. They're reading their environment to try.
What's
to,
one thing it teaches you?
Oh, wow, how to slow down. And,
I'm not trying to. That's not a Sarah Palin question.
But
what's the one thing I can teach you? I don't know. Teaches me everything.
Yeah, it's awareness. I don't know how to. I can simmering that down. It would be trying to be really aware of the environment around me and how much it does influence me.
Which really kind of grows from your interest in architecture and environment. In
yeah.
So, how do you make art from that? How do you?
Well,
obviously, you're interested in the environment.
Yeah,
you're interested in working with materials from the environment, at least in your new work.
Yeah. The most recent work was definitely environmentally responsive. It was the theme.
Do
of
you
the
want
show
to talk about that, or you want to talk about some of the older work first?
Maybe we can talk about that, and then
we'll see where we are.
The new work, it was very specific. You know, it was very different from all of the older work in that. I approached it from directly from a concept, and I typically respond to a space. I found it actually almost difficult not to have a space.
To make the work in?
There for me to respond to.
Really?
Yeah.
So as opposed to working in your studio?
A studio or...
Are you talking about doing more of an installation?
Installation type
yes.
of work. You know, I mean, I think one of the more well-known pieces that I've done was this piece at Plant Zero.
Mm-hmm.
And anybody who was there that has studios there knew, you know, I was there for, you know, many months really, but like this 1 3-week session where I was there every day and I bring in my materials, and the first couple of days they just see me sitting in corners and
mm-hmm.
kind of just, you know, spacing out whatever mm-hmm. you see when you walk into somebody and they're just sitting there.
Right.
And what I'm doing at that moment is kind of, feeling the space and having mm-hmm. it tell me the stories. And then I just start to pick materials from whatever ideas come into my head.
So you don't arrive with, I'm going to put this here.
No,
Very, very sensitive to the environment.
Yeah, it's more like, you know, the concepts will come into the head. This is what I'm seeing and thinking about while I'm sitting here. This is that
daydream. Because from my point of view, you know, like Plan Zero, for instance, there's four walls. Okay,
yeah.
What are you seeing I'm not seeing?
Oh, you know, it's like what I saw when I'm looking at the street just a minute ago in my coffee this morning.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when that whirlwind
right.
comes through and it all of a sudden it picks up the leaves mm-hmm. and the leaves get spun around. That type of movement and flow of mm-hmm. energy, you know, how people avoid corners. They typically are pushed away from a corner mm-hmm. and will move in a very organic line as opposed mm-hmm. to this rigid 90-degree mm-hmm. angle that we right. seem to make in architecture.
Right.
And they're easy. They're easy to make. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, you mm-hmm. build a 2x4 wall, that's what happens.
Right, right.
And not to mention the cost.
Right. It's harder to round
to
them off.
To make it curve, yeah.
Right.
So I think I look at that type of thing, and I see nature in those imposed human spaces
mm-hmm.
And how to kind of reinsert that type of flow and that type of dynamic movement of the energy or of the concept through the space.
Hmm.
So I'll have those images and the concepts come, then I would choose the materials based on what the concept
is. Are you doing any drawings at this time? Or
sometimes, the drawings and sketches may happen.
Right.
I mean, in my head, the images are just mm-hmm. flooding. And I keep a sketchbook. I write in this thing almost every day, mm-hmm. and I sketch in it almost every day. And so that will happen, and it's really interesting because all of this load will be acquired. You know, I'll mm-hmm. pull the concepts, and I'll pull the materials, and I may pull some sketches and do all of this type of juggling of info. And then once I take the materials and get in the space, all of that just in some ways disappears. You know, I just mm-hmm. kind of toss it to the wayside. I try mm-hmm. not to say, well, this is my design. This is my blueprint as an architect right. would use. You know, that disappears.
And
I take the materials and I respond very intuitively with the materials that I've selected and with the space that I have. Mm-hmm. So the idea could change completely.
So you're going from a very, very intellectual way of looking at it to a very intuitive way of responding to it.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Interesting.
And that's kind of been the way that I've worked for mm-hmm. for quite a while now. So this show that came up in Mayor was you know, I walked into the space and, you know, I medically had to do that because that's what I do. And felt the space, but then I realized that the piece was about this, you know, ecologically responsible work. And, you know, there's no title for this show yet or anything.
How do you define ecologically responsible work?
That's actually that's interesting. Yeah, that I realized immediately.
I mean, after you just drove an hour to get there.
No. Yeah, right. That this definition is huge and extremely right. pliable, depending upon the individual who's using the words.
Right.
I had to figure out what it was for me.
Mm-hmm.
The most impressive thing that just kind of knocked me down at that moment was that wow, I'm getting ready to move and. I'm going out to live in the country to mm-hmm. work at Cub Creek, this foundation that I'm living at right now for a residency. And it's a new landscape. And it's countryside. It's
right.
old pastoral landscape. You mm-hmm. know, it used to be a plantation. It's 113 acres I'm living on. And, you know, it's closer to the mountains. So immediately my heart starts to thump while I'm
right.
driving out there.
Right.
And I see the
right.
little Blue Ridge clippings mm-hmm. in the horizon. And I knew that, okay, I can't start the work until I get there. Because that's the ecology that I'm going to live in.
Right.
And that's where I can become responsible.
But so, how does this tie into what you're doing at Plant Zero?
Well, it's a different, completely different way of working in some directions,
uh-huh.
Which is new for me. I started a new method of working this summer when I tried to move
Okay, so we
objects.
Just shifted gears here.
Yeah, with big shift in gears.
Okay.
And did you see it?
Right.
It
was, what was the one at Plant Zero? I don't know that I did see it. What was it?
Stones, about a ton, 1 ton of chalet stone. That was suspended. These are 3 to 8 to 14 inch stones,
right?
Tied together with this artificial animal sinew that uh-huh. actually has been in almost every work that I've made. It's kind of my Ariadne's thread
mm-hmm.
for piecing all of my mm-hmm. body of work together. You know, tying these things together. I'm sitting in the space and I'm just. It's a very meditative process. It's like mm-hmm. you know, okay, well, when I get tired. It gets looser, and then when you know when I put these you know 25 pounds of stones together, if it's loose, it's going to fall apart.
Right.
You know,
right.
so I have to be there with every rotation around this stone, and that's that moment where the intuitive and this meditative type of process comes. You know, all the intellectual stuff is in the background. That's all done.
Right.
I can leave that behind, and I can become, as it were. And I can mm-hmm. be with the material.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, they're tied together. And then they're strung in these little clusters that kind of grow from, you know, 1 to 1 to 2. There's always a little lingering mathematics or Fibonacci
right.
floating in there somewhere. And that kind of happens, and I pull this whole thing together, and then it just takes off. I get this white material that I'd had left over in the studio, and I hang one in this tripod, and it's this very visceral cutting of this material once the stone's in it, uh-huh. and I'm trimming it away. It's I mean, I don't know exactly. It might be from when I was a kid and my granddad's got me out there skinning a deer,
like, right?
10 years old.
Yeah.
And that comes in, and I think there's very, primitive's such a funny word, but those type of primitive human moments, the tying of knots and mm-hmm. this kind of tearing of materials mm-hmm. and lashing. Mm-hmm. Those moments and those types of activities when I make work have always been really important to me, because they're things that everybody can do. So you can almost everyone can connect to tying of knots and
right.
having to do it over and over. But for me, they're so ingrained in just being who I am.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. As a climber, I mean, mm-hmm. I walk up into a crack and I'm in, 1,000 feet off the ground, and it's the knots that I tie and this system of lines and ropes that is keeping me alive.
Right.
And so that whole thing just comes together. A lot of my work's hung in space because of that.
Yeah. Interesting.
So yeah, that's the Plant Zero thing. But this one, I'm tying knots again.
Okay. Now we're talking about the new piece.
The ecology. Yeah.
This
thing in Mare. I walked around for a while.
What do you call the piece? I've got it here somewhere.
I called it Reverence. Titles were
you
so funny for me.
Really?
You know, I never... For the longest time, I just didn't want to title anything. I wanted to be that stubborn artist that's like, no, you know, the work
number
is
four.
The title. And like, this is, you know, just look at the work. Don't read anything about it. I can't stand putting a price by it, that's for sure, and anything like that, you know. I want you to look at the work. And so I called it Reverence because I think it boiled down to having a genuine respect for the landscape
mm-hmm.
and being grateful for mm-hmm. the landscape that you're living off of.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm not always tilling the soil out there and planting gardens. We have a garden.
But it sounds like you look at landscape almost the same way you look at architecture.
Yeah. I respect it highly, although architecture in so many ways, unless it's...
I mean, not exactly
well
the same
done.
Way, but I mean, you're really looking...
Yeah, I'm experiencing the lines, the qualities,
exactly.
the materials, everything. It's a very sensual, for lack of another word, experience.
Uh-huh.
And I daydream all the time. You know, I'm walking through that, and I just see that interplay of the wind flowing, you know, coming through the
mm-hmm.
environment. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, the sun and the passing of the day. It's all just very visceral and vivid for me.
Mm-hmm.
All that just really directly influences the way that I make work. But it's all over the board, you know. I mean, one week I'm doing this, and the next week I'm doing this. It was the only thing that I've ever been able to have people tell me was like, oh, you know, we can recognize that it's your work. And it was typically because it was tied together or there was something kind of archaic or
mm-hmm.
you know, very loose but mm-hmm. gestural to it. And I don't know. It's been really interesting kind of getting feedback.
But the piece that's now at the Mayor Fine Arts Center.
Can you describe it at all?
Yeah.
And that's down in Norfolk, right?
It's in Norfolk right now.
When's that show?
Comes
it's September
next week.
Wow.
Yeah. It opened up September 26th. We had the reception on mm-hmm. October 4th. So it's been up for, I guess, 3 weeks or more now.
But as long as we're talking about that, how does someone see your work on the web?
DavidBruceStudios.com.
Okay.
And there's a blog that you can go to mm-hmm. if you want to hear, you know, you can mm-hmm. read more about what I have to say about work or what I'm looking at, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way that I kind of keep the information flowing for my audience.
Mm-hmm.
I update it pretty regularly, I guess. I guess to get back to the field and the work, I walk through the fields here and immediately I'm you know, kind of hit by these grasses that are in all the fields that aren't being actively cultivated for mm-hmm. tobacco or whatever other mm-hmm. agricultural product. And it's these grasses. And I found instantly, not instantly, I guess I had taken these grasses and I had gone through the field and I gathered them, and they're annual grasses. So they're going to die away. And the mm-hmm. next year they're going to come back, and the seeds are being carried around by animals and they're just propagated everywhere. It's kind of the reclaiming of the field, the primary succession, the moment where the forest is beginning to reclaim that
mm-hmm.
field.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you keep bush hogging it, it's just going to be a field. But if you stopped, it's going to be a forest again one day. So this is that. There's something really nice about that. So I just started cutting these grasses from the base, brought them into the studio, and then I just kind of started peeling away the leaf, and they're segmented kind of like bamboo, but on a much smaller scale. Mm-hmm. So I peel away these leaves, and while I'm doing this, I'm just trying to be patient and breathe, because, I mean, there's thousands of stems of grass here that I have to go through. And, you know, everybody's looking at me like, aren't you supposed to be working in clay? Like, this is a ceramics facility. What are you doing playing with sticks, man? And I'm sitting here, and I'm cutting them, you know, I get down. And eventually I have this really gradient of color from these dark greens to these light greens that because mm-hmm. of the way that the leaf was on these stems. That alone was just really nice to set up on the table, and everybody's like, wow, you should just show that.
Right.
You know, yeah, that's great. But I had to keep going, so I started to experiment, and I started to tie them together.
Well, don't they change color? I mean, don't they dye and turn brown?
Over time, they'll fade, basically, just like any color will for the most part in the sun, and that didn't bother me at all.
Mm-hmm.
So I worried less about that and just kind of kept mm-hmm. going. I didn't want it to be about color, you know.
Right.
I wanted it to be about these other things that I was dealing with. So I just started tying, and then I tied incessantly for, you know, a week and a half, just tying these knots and like starting to build this very fluid form. It's I didn't want it to immediately be able to be referenced as, mm-hmm. you know, a vessel or a, you know, a deer, you know, I'm not making some representation mm-hmm. out of this. It is what it is. So I just built it. And then once it was done, it was that process of being grateful for the landscape that I was in every moment as I'm tying those knots. It's like, this is me tying myself to the environment. This is me being responsible to my environment because I'm choosing materials straight from this landscape. And they're fully renewable materials. Mm-hmm. And we had a group of middle-aged women come through. And they're a great, fantastic group of ladies, and they come in and they're looking at all the pots, and they're kind of on a little studio mm-hmm. visit for Cub Creek, and then they look over at me and they see me tying these knots, and three of these ladies immediately like, "What? Is that Johnson grass?" And I'm like, "Yeah, that's Johnson grass. Yeah, certainly is." She's like, "My husband, God, that is like, it's just a weed. He hates that stuff. It's like a battle every year to get rid of the Johnson grass. You know, so here's something that's a waste product. You know, a weed, this terrible thing." And they were just so excited to see that it was being, you know, elevated into some art form or something like that.
Right.
And I just laughed, and we talked about it for a little while. And then I took it into the gallery and you know.
But the thing that I've seen, or at least what I've seen on the web of it, looks like sticks.
These are the details, and they're being shot through the entire piece. And there is now an image on the
cover. So this is all grass?
It's all grass. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. And it's got to be, you know, if you count every time I literally tied an overhand knot, it's 10,000, 15,000 knots.
Wow.
But, it, you know, every little segment, it's probably about 3,000 segments.
Okay. And what shape is it?
It's
sort of amorphous?
It's pretty amorphous. It's somewhat amoeba-esque, as someone has described it,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. which, you know, that's the first free association that was made. And I think for me, part of that amorphous form, you know, I enjoy that moment right between the free association moment where, you know, you see that image that, the gestalt principle that just happens.
Right.
And it's like, oh, I see that.
Right.
You know, right before that happens, what is it? You know, it's that, what is this? That's a really interesting place. It's the boundary where the new information can just spring up at any
mm-hmm.
moment.
Mm-hmm.
Like the chaos, if you may, of the own mind. You know, your mind's trying to conceptualize what this thing is. Yeah, I love them. They're fantastic moments. So that was, you know, that's a very different piece because it didn't come directly from the space like the Plant Zero piece did.
Right.
I have to do this installation in space.
Right.
And that's actually one of the reasons I veered away from doing that, because I think the curator really wanted me to sort of redo the stones in her
mm-hmm.
space.
Mm-hmm.
Man, if I'd have done this, my heart's beating because her entire gallery is glass. And all I can see is people bumped into these things every once in a while. All I can see is that one moment of failure. I think, you know, Lewis Poole and some of these guys were doing maintenance over at Plant Zero.
Right.
And one of the guys clipped this giant door that was on the rail.
And
the door is like an old tobacco warehouse door.
Right.
And when they clipped the metal wire that was holding the door back, that door came rushing forward, clipped one of my lines, and here comes, you know, a 20-pound stone flying out of the sky onto the ground.
Wow.
Luckily, it didn't kill Zero or One, you know, the two cats that are always over there running around, or anybody else for that matter. So I get the phone call, and I can just imagine hearing Sheila call me saying that, you know, someone had just come in, and, you know, this person that can, you know, barely see. They weren't wearing their glasses. They ran into one of the lines. It broke, and then there's this swinging pendulum of 60 pounds worth of stone just went through, you know, a 10 by 10 glass window. And who's going to pay for it? You know, and I'm sitting.
So you went directly to grass.
I went straight. Yeah, you could throw this thing against that window. It's going to bounce off like a soccer ball.
Right.
So, okay. Yeah, it opted out for the installation piece.
Well, you said, I'll point out two concepts that come out of this inquiry that together shape the work that you see in this exhibition. The first is related to resourcefulness, using what you have in a creative way and not relying on a need to acquire materials that are outside of the local landscape. And you talked about that a little bit, but is that becoming more and more important to you?
I think the resourcefulness has always been really important to me because economics limits me every day, and I'm not born with a golden egg. Mm-hmm. So ultimately, I have to do with what I have, and that's been really important. And I think that's huge when you deal with the idea of ecology and being responsible is, you know, do with what you have. You know, do you really always need that next big thing? You know, it just becomes an issue, like being conservative in some way.
So green and environmental and all those buzzwords now are really starting to impact what you do?
I've always had the interest. The buzzwords are funny, you know, because when they first come out, they're good words. And then next thing you know, people are skewing the meaning because it's the brand that somebody, you know, some major corporation is using. They go, it's all green. They use the color green. And next thing you know, what you don't see is they're still drilling and they're still doing all these other things. They're still like mountaintop removable every day. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's tough, you know. I'm not here to make a major statement to change the world.
Yeah, you don't see this as political.
No, not at all. This has much more to do with me maintaining a direct connection to my environment so that I can't.
It almost, it almost sounds like Whitman, you know. It really is interesting. When you're talking about walking through the woods and stuff, I'm sitting here thinking, you know, and I saw your blog and you write.
I do write a little.
I mean, it almost seems like a Whitman, if there's such a word, a Whitman-esque response to your world through sculpture.
I haven't read enough Whitman to really be able to respond to that. I've been terrible about getting information from my forefathers, as you might say. You know, I've been so determined to, like, I'm focused here. This is me. You know, I can't speak through anybody else's voice but mine. So I just got to do what I do.
Well, guess what? We're out of time. It really does. I say this every time, but it zooms by. We've been talking with David Bruce. How would you describe yourself? Would you describe yourself as a ceramicist, as a sculptor, as a all of the above?
I'm a person who just loves what they do and loves learning from art. If you measure it from anything that I do, If people the box of sculptor, artist, climber, you know, whatever. Yeah, I used to just be like, I make things and I like to think a lot, and you'll find me in one of those modes most of the time. So. Whatever that may be, I am.
So how do you make a living?
Oh, man. That's a whole nother episode here.
All right. Well, we'll skip that.
Yeah.
Anyway. All right. Well, I want to thank you again, David Bruce, for talking with us today. And thank you folks for listening. We hope to see you on the radio again next Friday at 12:30. This is Tim Bowring, and you're listening to WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond's Indie Radio. Let's go for the rest of it.